connected.
Okay, this is my career cast, such as it is. This is Dana Neiswanger. Today is Monday, November 14th, 2005. I am using the Studio Recorder Beta to do this recording because I like this for simple recording voice and so forth. Also, the normalize option works quite well for this cheap microphone I have at this point. A couple remarks to preface this career cast with is when I first listened to many of the career casts, I really enjoyed hearing about people's careers and the various professions and goals they have and have aspired to. One of the things I have found in my own life is that my life has impacted my work, and my work has impacted my life in such a way that to tell one without the other would be unfair and unjust to both you, the listener, and a discredit to me, the liver, the one who's done this stuff. So I wrote to Larry and asked him about it, and I said, Larry, you know, it would take me maybe 30 minutes or so to tell my job resume and some of the integration problems I've had in the sighted employment sector and so forth, but I think that would be kind of boring. How about if I kind of weave the two together? And he said, no problem. It takes 2 hours, 3 hours. If people don't like it, they can delete it. So, you know, that's sort of where I'm going with this. In fairness to the listener, so that you know in advance, while there will not be any graphic elements to this career cast, there will be sections of it that are adult in nature, in that it deals with adult issues. Secondarily, for those of you who do not believe or subscribe to psychology theory, and or the fact that psychodynamic issues that exist from childhood can impact us as adults, you may want to delete this right now. I would be completely remiss, unfair to both of us, you the listener and me as well, if I didn't tell you that things that happened to me in my childhood both contributed to my success and to my failures. And so straight up from downtown, that's the word. The goal of all of my life has been since probably when I turned 40, I'm 49 now, has been to learn to laugh at myself and to learn to laugh harder and laugh more often at myself and not take myself quite so seriously. So that said, I hope you like it. It'll be interesting. As I said, my name is Dana Neiswanger. It's been said every way from nude swinger to last longer, so go ahead. You won't offend me none by attempting a different pronunciation than the one that actually exists. I was born the second of five children, January 7th, 1956. I have three brothers and a sister, my sister being the youngest child of the family, and I think she hates us all for it. Because we all waited a long time to get a sister, and my parents waited a long time to get a girl, and consequently, she is the baby of the family. I was born in Santa Monica, California. When my mother discovered I was blind, she began to investigate what it meant. She heard of a doctor in Washington, D.C., who might be able to do some surgery on my left eye and restore some of my sight. My right eye was removed at age 6 months. We moved to Pennsylvania, Altoona, Pennsylvania, to live with relatives, and commuted back and forth to Washington, D.C., and the surgery was eventually done. It's called an iridectomy, and I gather it involves removing a portion of the retina that's blocking the lens from obstructing the lens and keeping it from allowing me to see. This operation was successfully done at age 21 months and restored probably about 15% maybe vision to my left eye. I could not see good enough to read, as it turned out later on when I got to school, but I could see good enough to navigate without any mobility device. So at that point, I went to the Pittsburgh School for the Blind. I was 4.5 years old. Due to trauma that was inflicted upon me there by a house mother, I was seriously physically beaten. And the result of that was that not only did my mother pack us all up and move us back to California, swearing that she would no longer allow me to attend a live-in type school situation and or be segregated from general public schooling, she took us all back to California, where the public school system has resource programs that allow students who are blind to be, sort of streamed into the regular classroom setting. So that said, without going into any deeper details at this point on the impact of the abuse, except to say that it was pretty much forgotten and not ever mentioned again by me or my family for many, many years. I started school when I was 5. My birthday being in January allowed me to start school when I was 5 because I would turn 6 during the school year. I loved Braille, loved science, immediately took the whole thing, very much enjoyed school, and got along with the resource program quite well, and was very much interested in math and arithmetic and reading and writing Braille. I have always been quite articulate and quite opinionative. Consequently, this has gotten me into some trouble, as some of you may recall my spin the plate story as an adult. My mouth was getting me in trouble as a kid as well.
Message.
My first experience with my big mouth getting me into trouble would come in the second grade when my second grade teacher put two blanks in a sentence that we were to fill in the correct word from a list of spelling words we had to work with, and I thought, I guess, there was only supposed to be one word in a sentence, but she had actually put two blanks in the sentence, and I called her a cheater.
Message.
The result of this was that I was expelled from school for 2 weeks. This involved a big fight with my mom and the school authorities because after a week they wanted me to return to school. And my mother would not allow me to return to school unless or until they removed the black mark from my record. So they eventually did, and I returned to school, and no more was really said about the whole incident. I got along well with the other kids, no more than the usual childhood pranks, taking out my prostheses to scare the little girls in public school, and things like that were pretty much, my norm. I did do things like that just for fun. Otherwise, I got involved in with a friend of mine that was blind who moved from Colorado to California, and another sighted friend of ours. We're all quite into the space program and robotics, and at that point, our resource teacher spent a good deal of time recording on a little 3-inch reel-to-reel tape recorder for us articles on the laser beam, things that are commonplace in our lives today, infrared beams and so forth that are used in remote controls and CD players and DVD players, all those things that are so commonplace and ordinary in our lives today in 1962 and 63 were nothing but science fiction, barely becoming science reality at that point. Some of you may remember, if you worked with them, the old Wallensack tape recorders. And these were a very large, not really too big though, two-track reel-to-reel, 7-inch reel-to-reel machine that used the open reel tapes and were pretty heavy. And we lugged those things around, lugged them home with us. We had a taxi program that took us to and from school, and we would take those recorders home with us to listen to assignments on. One of the things that happened all too often throughout the entire academic process, throughout all of my public school up until high school, I guess, was that the teachers would pick their books when the school year began, and the resource teachers were running around playing step and fetch, trying to come up with a medium for us to use the book. So often it would not be in Braille to us, available to us in Braille. It was a book they read on tape or we got on talking book. My friend Ralph and I quickly discovered that because so many of us needed the book, we learned how to duplicate tapes. And so once a recording, a master, had been made, we would subsequently duplicate it so that everyone in the resource program who was blind could have a copy to use. We were 7 or 8 years old, as I recall, when we did this, made this discovery. The next big discovery came about the same time when we discovered that we could increase the speed from 3 3/4 to 7.5, which these machines were only two-speed machines, and do the duplication in half the time. This really impressed the resource teachers and the school teachers because they had never thought of it, and also the talking book versions of the books we used in school came in, on the 16 2/3 RPM 10-inch hard disks, and we would take those and speed it up to 33 1/3 and speed the tape recorder up to 7.5 and also be able to record the talking books in double time. This process we used throughout our school life to get this duplication thing done quickly so we could all get the books as soon as possible. We also started a robot club in the third grade and in our school. When John Glenn went into orbit, I'll never forget this, all three of us, Steve Hayes, Ralph Black, and myself, refused to come to school that day. And our parents just, had a fit, and the teachers, principal, Miss Woods, was quite upset about the whole thing. And finally, we agreed to go to school, provided Miss Woods would listen to the radio for us and let us know by ringing the bells three times when John Glenn had achieved orbit. And this was such a big deal to us. The space program was such a big deal. So, about this time, I guess we got our first job. I had have one older brother and two younger brothers. On the weekends, we solicited yard work. Back then, we lived in a neighborhood in San Bernardino, California, and the yard work was plentiful in this residential neighborhood. So many of the people didn't want to do their own yard work. My dad, who's been an auto mechanic all of his life, and we just lost Dad last year, always had work. I never recall a day, anytime we even moved, relocated, whatever, my dad always, the first thing he did is went out and found a job if he was no longer working where he used to work. So the work ethic is strongly instilled in all of us, all five of us children. Along with that, I will add that another goal that was always taught us as children and throughout our adolescence was that when you reach the age of 18, you have a choice. You get a job, go to work, get out on your own, you continue in school if you're going to stay here, or you join the military. Those were your choices, but the operative word here was get going, get busy, get started with your life. You're not going to freeload and stay here. So the work ethic was a very strong thing in all of us. And so as soon as we could, because we didn't get allowances and were not given money whenever we wanted it, my dad was always, you want money? Go make it. Here's ways. I'll buy you lawnmower. I'll buy you hedge shears. I'll buy you weed eaters. We didn't have weed eaters then, but I'll buy you edgers and the various mechanical devices to do yard work, and you can go out and solicit work on your own. This we did, and success we had. That was how we earned our money when we were kids. And many as the Saturday, I can remember going to spend our money after we had worked all day cleaning a yard, to get our goodies at the store or whatever, and come home, the reward for our efforts. So nothing really monumental happened. We were all, by the way, involved in Scouts at a very early age. The Cub Scouts of America was very active in San Bernardino, and we all All three of my brothers and myself were all very active in Cub Scouts. My mom was a den mother. My dad was a Cub Master for the pack, the local area pack. And we loved it. You know, it was great fun. It was a lot of activity, a lot of outdoor stuff. One of the big successes I can remember was we had a clothing drive. One Saturday we went out and we passed out these blue and yellow bags to area neighborhoods and left them on people's doors and hanging on their doorknob, and they were supposed to fill them up and put them out the next Saturday, and we would come around and collect them. Well, we did that the following Saturday. We went around and collected these bags, and it was amazing. Everyone wondered what part I would play in all this, because running up and down the steps, jumping off the truck and getting the bags was a kind of a difficult thing to do quickly. So I quickly became the organizer of the bags and kept track of all of them and kept them organized, and all the guys would holler, "How many we got? How many we got?" Every time we'd go into a new street, and I'd tell them the count on the bags, you know. Later on that night, it turned out we had gathered up more bags than anyone else, because we had organized this system that, you know, my dad was driving the truck and the guys were going and getting the bags, and I was keeping them all straight and organized in the back, and we gathered up more bags than anybody else. And the Cub Master, of course, my dad, spoke of our teamwork, you know. So this was the kind of thing that my parents got me involved in, so that I was always integrated. I played with the neighborhood kids. You know, we rode bikes. You know, I had a two-wheeler bike. I could see good enough to ride. And as long as I was careful and, you know, rode with my brothers, you know, everything was cool. So I had a pretty much normal childhood until I reached the age of 10. When I got to be 10 years old, the pressure began to rise. I should point out here that I'm sure I forgot to mention that the cause of my blindness was glaucoma. My mother had German measles when she was pregnant with me, and this brought about the glaucoma in my eyes. When I was 10, the pressure began to rise in my left eye. Multiple visits to the eye doctor didn't reveal any hope of doing anything about it. During my 11th year, I went through 5 major surgeries, missed a lot of school, which wasn't really a bad thing because I did all right in school. I didn't really have any significant problems as far as the work was concerned. But the surgeries were to try to reduce the pressure, unsuccessfully. And finally, the 5th surgery was to remove the working parts of the eye, something they call an evisceration rather than an enucleation, which is when they remove the whole eye. And they you know, put the muscles around a plexiglass sphere and then fit a very thin prosthesis over it. And that is your eye and supposed to allow it a certain amount of mobility. Well, unfortunately, in 1967, they didn't have this process very well perfected, and it really didn't work out too well. So in any case, I went through the transition of losing the last of my vision. My sight was precious to me. I, to this day, am very grateful to the fact that I had it for the time that I did, that I got to enjoy it, that I still remember it, that I can still picture what people are describing, that I have color memory, I see in my dreams. All those things are very relevant in my life, and the fact that I had the sight. I went through a pretty significant transition, though, on behalf of the sight. I got depressed. It was difficult. Mobility and orientation was awkward. I even went through the phantom sight process, where I believed that I could still see, and it took me a while to accept that I, in fact, could not. This was difficult for the family. But by the time I got into my 12th year, I was able to do this, and I was finishing up 6th grade. The only real step I had to take to get used to it was to spend summer school at the junior high school that I would enter when I was 13. Actually, when I was 12 still. I hadn't yet turned 13, but the junior high school I would start when I was 12 in the 7th grade, I had to spend summer school taking classes and orienting myself to the school. And by that time, I had pretty well adjusted to being totally blind, still having a good deal of contact with my friends Ralph and Steve, because we all basically went through the same school system process together and flowed through the school system and attended the same schools. So we got to spend a lot of time together. Really got into the mixing of tapes and having a lot of fun. In fact, one of the things I will eventually put up either in a segment on Blind Cool Tech or on my own podcast, which I certainly hope to get to at some point here in the not too distant future, will be I have magnetic tapes on cassette that have been restored from reel to reel, old reel to reel tapes of me clear back in the seventh grade and my friends and stuff we did and things we recorded. So you'll get to hear us all before our voices even changed, and even after. I have always been, like so many, a recorder, and we call these things blind guy videos, and I would carry a recorder around with me wherever I went a lot of times and just record things and different events in my life. And so we did this, and we mixed a lot of tapes together for fun. In junior high school, allowed us some time because of the taxi program that shuttled us to and from school, both before and after school, waiting on the cabs to arrive. And once we got there, we were always there a little early to play music tapes in the resource room and stuff. And so, it was a fun time. Junior high school went fairly well, although I will say that I came into contact with, for the first time, vices. Cigarettes were the first thing. One day I had another friend that I had made in junior high school, and he and I got together, and I could still remember doing this. We snuck into a FedMart grocery store that had a cigarette machine, put 35 cents in the cigarette machine, and bought our first pack of cigarettes. It was a pack of Trues, and we spent all day in the wash out behind the apartment complex in the carport area where I lived, trying to smoke up all these cigarettes. And so we became absorbed in testing the limits, as it were, and went through the usual stuff that adolescent kids do with stealing a beer and finding out what that tastes like and so forth. So not really a problem at this point, but I went on through 7th, 8th, and 9th grade with no major difficulties. Fortunately, we got to do a lot of really neat stuff in gym, and we got to have a lot of wonderful activities that we participated in, and we had a fairly good resource teacher who allowed us to try different things. Couple of things I can remember is the hanging, the climbing rope on the in the yard exercise area had come unfastened and was down, and we loved to climb that rope. So me and another guy decided we were going to replace that rope. This we did. It involved climbing way up on a stanchion that was very high, and climbing these kind of 90-degree poles to this stanchion and getting up on this top bar and laying along it with socket wrenches and unscrewing these bolts on a rope fitting that held the rope in place and putting up the new rope and tightening the bolts back down with the socket wrenches. And the guys were out there from the student union taking pictures of this, and it ended up in the junior high school yearbook, which I still have. We were known as the aerial mechanics, me and this other blind guy, because we did this. So in any case, it was an interesting time in our lives, and we got to a chance to excel at different things. Finally, it was time for high school. And San Bernardino High School had just been built. It was a brand new high school. Keeping in mind that I think it's important to mention here that we were not allowed to use canes or any mobility aids in school. We went around snapping our fingers like this all the time. Interesting, I'm hitting the limiter apparently when I snap my fingers. In any case, we snapped our fingers to bounce sound waves off of objects and or walls and so forth to get about. That's how we got around. We felt with our feet along the edges of sidewalks and flower beds and so forth to get where we wanted to go. We learned to hear doorways, banks of lockers, all kinds of things like that that were sound issues to those of us who were blind that we needed to know to get about, to orient and get about. So, we started in high school. The high school was substantially bigger than the junior high school. Three area junior high schools were combined into one high school, which made a big sophomore influx into the high school system. And this being a new high school was difficult to navigate. It was spread out, a big campus. You had to actually cross a street to get to the shop area and gym area and electronics area and different places where certain elective classes were held. It was difficult doing that with no cane, no mobility aid. But that was the way they wanted it. They claimed, these things could be used as weapons or something. I don't really know what the rationale was behind it. It was just an accepted thing that you didn't have these mobility aids as a blind person in school. In fact, in high school, there were lots of violent problems with the regular, regular students. There were racial problems, as you probably remember. In the mid to late 60s, the Watts riots in Southern California all impacted the school where I went and the people, the students that went there. So this caused a great deal of interracial tension, and there was a lot of violence there anyway. So I guess all of that tied into the mobility aids thing, and in any case, we weren't allowed them. So high school started. I lasted at San Bernardino High School less than 3 months. What happened was we had a bad habit of going down into the restrooms to smoke during what they called nutrition break between second and third period. And I got in a fight down there with a student, with another student, who I thought was a student. Turns out he wasn't. He was just hanging out on campus. He was an older guy. And when I went home and my mom saw my jaw all swollen up and everything like that and, delved into what happened, she went after the school system, she went after the school board. By this time, we had moved 22 miles out of town up the mountains in San Bernardino, and my brothers all went to a different school, a different high school and junior high school. My mom wanted to get me mainstreamed at that point and out of that environment. So this she proceeded to do. It took about a month. And I was allowed to attend Rim of the World High School because my grades were good enough. And I attended Rim of the World High School for the rest of my sophomore and junior and senior years in high school. High school and junior high school are now what they call middle school and high school, I guess. And middle school is 6, 7, and 8, and high school is 9 through 12. But in any case, it was different then. It was 6 through 9 and 10 through 12, broken up. But in any case, Rim High was my salvation. When I got there, the first thing I found out was they had a school radio station, closed-circuit radio station that was wired into the lunchrooms and places in the school where people could listen to the guys broadcasting on it at lunch. I found out they had a drama club. I got involved in dramatics. I got involved in the radio club. It was a total change in reality for me. My drama teacher, a wonderful guy by the name of Bill Dixon, who I would see 20 years later after I graduated at my high school reunion, which was just great. He really pulled me aside and worked with me to get me to try this stuff. I ended up acting in plays like Stalag 17, Up the Down Staircase, The Odd Couple, Mr. Roberts, Flowers for Algernon. I did monologues. I memorized stories like Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart, and did these things before my drama class and even before audiences. I got involved in the closed circuit radio station and had a show on Wednesdays at lunch. This became my area of interest, was doing something with this, what everyone says, and I have now come to believe, is this wonderfully great voice I have. But in any case, not to pat myself on the back, but it seems that I'm supposed to use this voice for something in my life. So thus I am. In any case, I started attending junior college 2 days a week when I was a junior in high school in order to get, they had a co-op program that would allow us to attend junior college, get both high school and junior college credits at the same time. So this I did, and I went to Valley Junior College in San Bernardino with another guy from my high school class, and we both took telecommunications classes. This also got us on the college radio station, so now we were on a real radio station as well. And this was just great fun to be, 15 years old and really broadcasting on a real live radio station was just truly exciting. 15 and 16, and I went throughout the whole process of the last 2 years of school attending college 2 days a week to get these broadcasting credit courses, course credits. So in any case, I did this. My brothers and I continued to work throughout all of this, I want to point out. On the weekends, we cut wood in the mountains. Wood was an essential element to mountain living. People had fireplaces, they heated by wood, they used wood, we sold wood by the cord. We had chainsaws, and we had a truck, and my older brother drove, and we went out and cut and split wood. And one of my favorite things to do was to use a sledgehammer and a wedge to split wood. My favorite sound was when this wedge would get all the way through the log I was splitting, and the very last stroke of the sledgehammer would break through the final fragments of wood and send this wedge ringing off into the air, and it was a really neat sound. I mean, it would just ching, you know, and it would go flying off into the air, and it was a great sound. It was really a very satisfying sound to one who had stood there and swung this sledgehammer over your head enough times to get it through the log. And so it was a very, very good time. My dad, being a mechanic, I can remember in my summer between my junior and senior year, decided I need to learn about mechanics and cars. So he went to a wrecking yard. He got an old Chrysler engine. We bolted it to a big tree stump that we had had a tree cut down in our yard and left the stump. And my dad taught me how to take apart and rebuild an engine, and I mean by hand, folks. And, I stood there and ground the valves by hand and all these things. You know, the only thing we had done was the heads turned and everything. And, you know, I mean, those were the things that we had done at the actual mechanics type garage where my dad worked. So otherwise, I did all this by hand just to learn the principles and theories of a combustion engine. This was a big deal. My mom and dad continue to be active. Oh, I guess I should also mention that another hobby of ours was the CB radio. Another friend of mine who was blind, who went to school in the Long Beach area, was into Citizens Band Radio, and he gave me an old CB of his, and my mom and dad helped me get it hooked up, and they became interested in it, and so my mom and dad and I became known as Big Wheel, my mom, Bumper Jack, my dad, and Hubcap, that was me, as our CB handles. And we had, you know, our CB radio club that we belonged to. And one of the highlights of that was my antenna raising party, where all these guys came up with their tree climbing gear and climbed a 125-foot pine tree and put my PDL quad beam antennas on a rotor, an electric rotor, up in the top of this pine tree. And we actually became a relay station for the Civil Defense Network in our area because we could really get out then. I mean, we had a walk the dog station that, without any benefits of a linear amplifier or things like that, that people used illegally to increase their power and their range of broadcast. We were able to do this just by simple aerial, you know, dynamics. We had the height on them, so you know, it was great fun, and we enjoyed that, and it became a great pastime throughout the junior and senior high years. I graduated June 14th, 1973. 5 days later, I finished my college courses and was off to the Orientation Center for the Blind in Albany, California. When I got there, it was my first flight. I'd never flown. I flew from Ontario to Oakland. And got there and was chauffeured by the housekeeper who met me at the airport to the orientation center and got oriented and acquainted with the place fairly quickly. A lot of things were about to happen in my world real fast. My second night there, keeping in mind I was but 17 years old, I was invited to go with my friends to the Viking Cocktail Lounge that I had made, a little place right down the road at San Pablo and Clay in a little shopping center. We went down there, and I walked in, didn't get carded. Nobody asked for my ID, nobody asked me any questions, they served me drinks, no big deal. So from then on, I just drank whenever anybody wanted to go drinking, because it was easy. And I had the money. I had my SSI check by this time. My parents let me have it free and clear to live on while I was at OCB, so I had money. I got along okay. I was smoking by this time. I smoked openly now, not having to any longer hide it from my parents, which I did up until the time I left home that first time. And by the way, that was the time and the only time I left home. I also discovered sex at the orientation center. It was within the first week of my arrival there. It was also discovered very quickly that I was an excellent cane traveler. I had great orientation and mobility skills. Apparently all of this stuff from not being allowed to use a cane during school added to the fact that I now had the added confidence of having the cane just made me this kind of person who wasn't afraid to walk, you know. I got out there and moved it, and wasn't afraid of anything any longer at all. There was absolutely no inhibitions about getting about. So I quickly learned all the area streets and bus routes and things like that, and made friends with friends from former students of OCB who came back to visit, and we, you know, spent a lot of time in Berkeley and some time over in San Francisco. I met my first real true love girlfriend from San Francisco. I spent the rest of that year until December 14th at OCB. I went home on December 14th. I was home for Christmas. By January the 18th, I had had it. I couldn't hang. I just, you know, the world was calling me, and home was no more fun anymore, no matter what it had to offer. So I called my girlfriend. She at that point had moved to Sacramento to get in the BEP program, the Business Enterprise program, and I said, well, hell, I'll give that a try too. So she said, come on up and you can live with me. She had an apartment. I went to Sacramento, moved in with her on the 18th of January, and we started up housekeeping together, as well as attending the Business Enterprise program. So I was in the class after her, and so I had a few months to kill until the class started. So one of the operators, in fact the trainer, the primary trainer, told me, a couple of operators, that I might go offer myself up for a trainee position just to work in their stand to get the experience. This I did, and I met two very good friends. One I still have today. His name is Lon Sumner. He lives in Sacramento, California. One died in 1980. His name was Tom Long. He was a great guy whom I really admired and respected. He ran the cafeteria, and Lon ran the vending stand in the Consumer Affairs Business and Professions Building at 1020 N Street in Sacramento. So I went to work for these guys. I alternated whenever they needed me, running their cash stands or working at their cafeterias. And I did that for February and March and April. And in May, I started my training program. Eva had finished hers, and she began her OJT, and which was a two-month requirement after you finish the four-month training program. So I started my four-month training program. We were still living together. And I went on through the whole process of the four-month BEP program. Had no problem with it, math being easy to me, orientation being easy, getting about without using a cane in a small setting and so forth was easy. So it was easy for me to navigate the cafeteria and not trample the customers or knock hot cups of coffee out of their hands and things like that. I didn't have any real problems with getting about. So, I worked quite well in the BEP program, finished my 4 months. By this time, Eva had gone for her first selection committee and missed her first chance, but got her second chance at a post office, not post office, but a, I'm trying to remember what the building was. Anyway, it was a small building at 47th and Van Ness downtown in San Francisco, and she had the cafeteria there. So she moved back to San Francisco and got an apartment out of Daly City, top of the hill in Mission Street, and right at the end of the electric bus lines that run up and down Mission Street in Daly City. She got a little apartment there, and she started there working at that. And so I commuted back and forth. I was on OJT in Sacramento by this time and trying to finish out my program, and she, I would go down and visit her on the weekends and, help her with her stand. Well, it was projected that I was going to do well at this. And in fact, I could have. What I quickly found out, however, is that I was so good at doing this work for under-the-table money that these guys would pay me in cash, that I would rather earn the cash and not have the responsibility of running the business so that I could keep my SSI and earn the cash as well, and all that sort of thing. And so that is what I ended up doing. Rather than going for selection committees, I worked as a relief operator for other vendors in the Sacramento and even in the San Francisco area, and was paid pretty good money under the table because I was able to memorize all their routines and was trustworthy, and they could throw the keys to me and say, I'm going here and going there and I'm not going to be here for a week and I need you down here or I need you over here, and I'd jump. And that was a commodity, a valuable commodity at that point in the cafeteria, the business enterprise program. So that really probably caused a certain amount of demise of my interest in the program because it really became too easy. It wasn't challenging enough. I ended up finally taking one of my own two locations, which was the Monterey County Courthouse wet vending stand. This meant it served hot food items, coffee, soups, things like that, that could be prepared in a microwave or an infrared oven rather than an actual grill and hot entree affair, full-blown cafeteria, or even a small cafeteria. It was what they called a wet vending stand. The only problem with this was the methadone treatment clinic for heroin addicts was on the third floor of this building. And the police department, the sheriff's department, was also in this building. Well, a totally blind guy trying to work a cash drawer with no bill identifier was quickly taken advantage of by these hopeless dopers coming to get their methadone. I can't tell you, the first month I think I lost $165 to bill theft. It went steadily up from there. I lasted about 2.5 months. My BEO, my supervising business enterprise officer, would not give me a bill identifier. The things were like $750 at that point. They were not these little portable handheld devices either. They were a rather large thing that actually drew the bill through the device on a conveyor system and spoke the denomination. He would not get me one of those. He just said, hold it up and call out to someone to verify it for you. Well, these guys would tag, double team me, you know. They'd get somebody to come in to verify their bill for them, and they'd hit me in an off moment when nobody else was around, and what could I do? And in the meantime, while I'm making change, they're swiping cigarettes out of my cigarette rack and whatever else they could get their hands on. So I really was in a bad position at this location, and I finally got disgusted. Threw the keys in the cash drawer one day and left, and went home, went back to Southern California, moved back to Southern California from Sacramento, left my apartment. Eva and I had kind of decided that life was taking us in two separate directions at that point, so we kind of, said our goodbyes and went on our roads, our respective roads together, together alone, if you'll pardon the oxymoron, and, we're okay with that. So I moved back to Southern California. Well, I really didn't want anything else to do with the BEP program at this point, so I happened to run into a couple of guys up the mountain, we call it up the mountain in Crestline where I lived, that I had gone to high school with, both sighted guys. And they were paramedics for the county fire department. And they worked like 3 days on and had 4 days off. And they spent 3 days and nights at the fire station, and then they would come home for 4 days. And they wanted to all get a house together. So we did that. And I hung out at the house a lot of times, also attended a few classes at the Valley Junior College, again, trying to complete my degree in telecommunications, but not really getting anywhere with that. Just kind of goofing around, trying to, because unfortunately the public transportation wasn't such that I could get up and down the hill to Valley College by any means other than someone driving me, and the rides were scarce and hard to come by, and I couldn't always get a ride, and so I missed a lot of classes and it became a problem. Finally in 1977 I got a call from a guy who was a supervising business enterprise officer trainee while I was in the program, and he and I kind of liked each other. He liked me a lot. He called me and he said, look, Dana, I've got this location. He was a BEO by now. And he said, I've got this location in Pasadena at the gas company. I need an operator for it. The guy that ran it died. And I need you to come down there and operate this cafeteria for me until I can get someone just as an interim operator. I said, okay, Alan. So, I moved to Pasadena, moved into the Y, and lived at the Y and began running this cafeteria in Pasadena. So it was actually not a bad little place. I found some pretty decent help. I could have one employee there, and it was fairly decent. It was what they call a submarginal location, which meant that it earned less than $600, I think it was, a month or something like that. And it was, therefore subsidized by the gas company. They paid me an additional salary to run the place because the net income of the place was so low. So I ran this place for about 8 months while he went through the process, supposedly, of getting a new operator. Well, he hoped that I would keep the place and just stay there. But a lot of things were going on. Unfortunately, the environment at the Y was bad. The people I had fallen in with were bad. Got into a little drug use there. Got into a lot of illicit sex there. There were women that I knew in the area. Things just kind of went a little crazy at that point in my life. I had some problems that I wasn't facing with my own sort of self-defeating behavior at that point, and I was not able to get a handle on it, so I ran from it. And the escape was through drugs, alcohol, sex, things like that. I kept this up till August of 77, and finally the guy that cooked for me and washed dishes for me, who was from Michigan, said, hey man, why don't we pack it in and go to Michigan, So I said, okay. So I actually did it right this time. I didn't just throw the keys in the drawer. I called the department and said, hey, I'm leaving, and I'm resigning from the program for personal reasons. And they said, okay, fine. So they closed out the shop and got somebody else to run it, and me and my friend, believe it or not, set out one night with backpacks on our shoulders from the YMCA and hitchhiked to Michigan from Pasadena, California. It took us 6 days, which is actually pretty good hitchhiking. I mean, we got good rides, we made it to Michigan, to his hometown, which was a little place called Coleman, Michigan. Things began to get progressively worse from that point on. I didn't like it in Michigan. I was removed from any sort of service base. The town of Coleman has exactly one stoplight in the whole town. It was just not my kind of thing. I was used to city living, and it didn't in any way compare with the small mountain community I spent the latter part of my adolescence in. I was really kind of disturbed and discouraged at that point about what to do. Mike and I weren't getting along too well. We lived in a 10 by 55 trailer, and it was close proximity, and we were trying to live on my SSI, and he couldn't seem to keep a job, and it was just problematic. Things were going bad. Well, this was when things really started to unravel for me. I had gone to the doctor. The doctor had given me a legitimate prescription for Valium, and one night I just swallowed the whole bottle. I ended up in the hospital in Midland, which was about 20 miles or so from Coleman. In any case, I ended up in the hospital, going through the usual process of resuscitation from an overdose, the charcoal, the having your stomach pumped, the blech. It's something you do not want to go through, believe me, under any circumstances. It's not any fun. And ended up an inpatient at the psychiatric unit. It was at that point that some doctors took an interest in me, one good psychiatrist and another fairly good psychologist took an interest in me and began to explore what was going on with me that I wasn't dealing with that caused me to seek out this sort of illicit activity when I had such good things going on for me, when I had a lot of good qualities and a lot of talent and a lot of skills and a lot of abilities, and just threw them away because, it was too easy. It was all too easy. The counterculture, the underworld, the dark side, whatever you want to call it, was more interesting and more challenging. I can tell you with absolute certainty that the dope dealers and the bad guys, they'll treat you the same. They believe in equality. I can remember one time, complaining to this guy because I had gotten ripped off in a deal. And I said, "Man, you guys just screw me because I'm blind." And he sat there for a minute, thought about it. He said, "Nah, we'd screw you anyway." That's just the way they dealt with it. It was, they didn't treat you as an unequal, whereas in society, a lot of times we face those problems of equal worth as folks who are blind. I didn't have that problem in the counterculture, so I stuck with that, unfortunately, to my eventual undoing, as if a suicide attempt wasn't bad enough. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. I spent a month in this inpatient psychiatric unit, and these doctors began to confront me with some of my problems, one of them which is that they said that I wasn't dealing with my blindness, which really astonished me because I had all the adjustment skills down pat. What I did not realize at all was that there were a lot of things that made me uncomfortable about being blind, made me feel inadequate, like less of a person and a second-class citizen. I bought into the whole rehab psychology and mentality, children of a lesser God, whatever you want to call it. So that was a real problem, and I didn't know it then. But they were trying to show it to me. God knows, Harvey Chapin and Dr. Vandrick, those two doctors really tried, man. They really tried to show it to me. But it just didn't take. Well, there was a public housing project went in called the Greenville Townhouses in Midland, and it was brand new, and it was sectionated, and I got an apartment there. Cost me $32 a month, utilities included. At that time, I think SSI was about $276 or $286. So, you know, it wasn't too bad. I got along okay there. I quickly got involved with some guys who saw my potential in the counterculture world and in the bad stuff. And unfortunately, I was extended a line of credit, and I quickly got into selling drugs along with a friend of mine who was trustworthy. And the two of us lived together in my apartment, and we sold dope. We continued to do that throughout 1978, you know, just engaging in all the activities that go along with that sort of thing. You know, the partying, the sex, the drugs, the rock and roll, going to concerts. You know, I did get to see some good concerts and stuff, I guess, if you want to attribute something out of that whole period of my life that might have been good. But in any case, in 1979, we were selling to a kid that dealt at the high school, and he set us up, and we got busted in 1979, and we both went to jail. I spent 49 days in the Midland County Jail, and got a public defender, went to court. They had done this pre-sentencing investigation hearing on me, and what they determined was, and what the judge told me, and I'll never forget this, Judge Tyrone Gillespie sat there behind his bench and said, "Dana, if even half the stuff I read about you in this report is true, you're not going to have any trouble doing your time." And he sentenced me to 2 to 5 years in Jackson State Penitentiary for being a drug dealer. Didn't matter to them at all. My lawyer kept telling me that I wouldn't go to prison because I was blind and it was a first-time offense. But I did. You don't believe me? My prison ID number is A158750. You can check with the Michigan State Department of Corrections. I have no reason to lie. If I'm going to lie, I'm going to tell you something good about me that's a lie and not something bad. But in any case, I went to prison. My partner got 8 to 20, I got 2 to 5. We were separated. We were put in two different institutions. I went through 19 days quarantine at Jackson Penitentiary and was transferred out to the Riverside Correctional Facility in Ionia, Michigan. I spent my next 22 months there. During that 22 months, it was quickly discovered that I could type with both hands. This was an invaluable commodity, as many of the inmates are trying to get back to court on a writ and or trying to get some sort of legal action to set them free. So this became an invaluable commodity, made me an invaluable commodity to the prison economy. I could actually get away with charging $3 a page in script money. We had plastic money, much like poker chips in those days. Now they have these electronic debit cards, much like the free world has, that the inmates use to transact business within the institution. But nevertheless, in those days, we had these poker chip style monies, quarters, dimes, nickels, and dollars. And I would charge $3 a page for perfectly typed work. And I made money that way while I was in prison. Because the statutes had not yet changed legally, and I was smart enough to get my direct deposit account set up for my SSI, the government didn't know I was in prison. So I continued to receive my SSI check monthly, directly deposited in my bank. I hooked up with someone on the outside who would do money transfers for me, and who would go get money out of my bank account and send it to me via the institutional mail, and it would be deposited in my bank account, so I had even more money. I did well in prison. I became a unit representative to the Warden's Council for my prison block. That means that 529 men out of my prison block called me the prez and liked what I knew how to do. I was articulate. I was intelligent. I got them stuff. I got them a microwave oven. I got them a pool table for their day room. Things they didn't have, TV rights to the Super Bowl and stuff like that that they didn't have before to watch Super Bowl on the color TV. And in the day room, you know, all kinds of things. So there were a couple of guards that took an interest in me while I was in prison. Stan Gephardt and Dave Cotter certainly deserve credit for what they did. It was Dave that began to teach me about a God of my own understanding. This was a concept foreign to me, as I had been introduced to Christianity and thought I went through the salvation experience when I was like 14 years old. But I was actually doing it to get a resource teacher who was trying to, I mean, a Braille transcriber who was trying to drag all the blind kids to church off my back. So I just did it to shut her up. But I really didn't go through the salvation experience. In any case, Dave began to teach me about a God of my own understanding and to develop a concept for what that might be and who he might be. Stan Gephardt was interested in computers and electronics. We began to discuss the concepts for what we would build, a simple device that would talk and how it would work, what phonemes were. We had no idea that Sharp Electronics in this very same time period was building the very first talking clocks, which was a $60 device that was about the size of a 100 millimeter pack of cigarettes that you carried around in your pocket, that you pushed one button on. The NFB sold them for like $60, and they were a very synthetic sounding voice. I still have mine, by the way, and it still works, by the way. And these Sharp talking clocks were the first talking clocks, and I would not get this clock until a few years later. But in any case, we were designing this theory while I was in prison. Stan was building his own computer at home. And so we got into this, and I really took to this stuff. You know, I wanted to learn it. It was important to me. So, you know, it was something that I thought I might just be able to do, and it might be challenging and interesting. Well, I'm sure Lynette is shocked at this point because she thought I was joking in a message I sent to her earlier, but in fact, what I told you, Lynette, was true. In 1981, when it was time for me to go for my parole hearing, it became apparent I had to have a place to go. I wrote to my parents. My parents had moved to Charlotte, North Carolina by this time to go to work for Jim and Tammy Faye Baker at the PTL Club. And this they had accomplished. And they had moved from California with my sister to go to work for Jim and Tammy. So I paroled to my parents in Charlotte, North Carolina. I can remember one significant thing about my parole hearing, which was the warden showing up saying, "If you don't parole this man, I'm going to have to transfer him to another institution because he could either single-handedly organize a prison riot or a break, an escape, and I don't want him here anymore." So they paroled me and let me go, and I'm grateful that they did. I got to Charlotte, North Carolina. This is the funny part of the story, really. My parents decided to do the yellow ribbon thing. They had all these huge yellow ribbons all around the front yard, I mean, draped over anything that would hold them. They had this huge banner out along the picket fence, the split rail fence in front of the house, that said, "Welcome home, Dana." Well, they lived on a fairly busy street here in Charlotte that still is here, called Tivola Road. One day, a news cameraman driving by saw the banner and stopped to see what was going on. My mom and dad just told him. He said, "Really?" He said, "Your son's blind and he's in prison?" They said, "Yeah." "Well, do you mind if we kind of follow this story, you know?" So he went back to his news people at WPTV Charlotte here in Channel 3 and got him interested in this story. So unbeknownst to me, I come strolling off the airplane quite ill at ease coming home after my prison sentence and not really feeling real good about things, wondering where my life was going to go from here, right into the eyes and ears of all Charlotte via WBTV Channel 3. They were there to meet me at the airport. They followed me home. They wanted the whole story. I told it. There was a guy that saw it on TV. The thing ran. It ran 15 minutes into the news, the 5 o'clock news. They didn't just run it once. They ran it 3 times over the next 2 days on different news broadcasts. And And this guy saw it. His name was Dave Prevett. Very, very dear friends of ours. In any case, Dave came to my our house, knocked on the door, and he asked my dad if he could come in and talk to us. And my dad said, sure. He said he saw the spot on the news and wanted to know if I knew what beatball was. And I said, no, never heard of it. And he began to explain the game of beatball to me. Well, he invited me and my dad to come watch a practice on Saturday, and this we did. I loved it. They let me have a try at it, and I immediately took to it. It was great. I had remembering competitive sports from the little bit that I got to participate them in them in school. It just was something I really loved. The beatball program here in Charlotte, North Carolina at that time was sponsored by the Pioneers of America and Bell South, and or Southern Bell, actually, at that time it was called. Southern Bell volunteers all sponsored the program, all did all the work and, you know, raised the money, drove us around to the games and everything like that, and were our friends. One of those volunteers was a sighted field assistant and scorekeeper named Regina Teasley. And I met Regina on my first Monday night official practice. And we sort of exchanged some dialogue in passing over the next couple of weeks. And eventually got around to, I asked her if she wanted to go on a picnic. You know, she always accuses me of getting this stuff out of order, so I got to be careful here. In any case, we got to Corton, as it were. We had an annual beach trip with this beatball team that we went to Wilmington, North Carolina for a week at the beach, and the final games of beatball usually were coincided with this event. And so we went down there, and Regina and I had this very romantic encounter at a bonfire on the beach where we strolled along the beach. I also, at 2:30 in the morning, ended up burying her all but her head in the sand and, you know, sounding the alarm that I couldn't find Regina. And when they all came running to help me find Regina, there was Regina completely buried in the sand and nothing but her head sticking up when they came across it with the flashlights. It was really quite amusing. But in any case, Regina and I began to have our beginnings of what would become our marriage. We continued to play beatball. I asked Regina to marry me. I'm wanting to say sometime in early November. I remember the event, but not the date. We were babysitting for a little boy. And that was where it happened. In any case, we decided to get married. My parents were totally against it, said it would be the worst mistake I ever made in my life. I was living with them at the time. This caused a fairly good rip in the family for quite some time. My parents at this point were not working for PTL anymore. My dad was working for an auto garage as a mechanic again, as he did so often in our life. My mom wasn't working, and my sister was still at home. It was her senior year in high school. She was in a private Christian school. She didn't want to leave, but my parents were determined they were going to leave. I don't really know how much me and my activities had to do with it. April of 1982, I had moved into an apartment, and this was where Regina and I were going to start our marriage. We were to be married on May the 22nd of 1982. My parents left April 20th, 1982, for Arizona to live with my brother and his wife and get started up out there. I'm still not exactly sure why they did that. They felt that change was in order, I guess, in their life. It turned out to be a bad thing for them, and they didn't last very long, as my story serves to tell. In any case, Regina and I got married on May the 22nd, 1982. Throughout all of this, I had started at Central Piedmont Community College, attending data processing classes, working very hard, spending hours of time with the Opticon in the lab, dreaming of a HP 125 from Maryland Computer Services, which, as some of you know, was the beginning CPM level machines that began to do the talking for us. A lot of people were at that point reaching out to any means to make computers talk they could or to access them. I was still using the Opticon and the lens to read the screen to do all my COBOL and related JCL programming. So I continued with that until I had completed my degree during our marriage. By 1983, my parents had not made a go of it in Arizona. They moved back to Charlotte, North Carolina. We got them jobs at the apartment complex and an apartment at the apartment complex and furniture, and set them up again, here in Charlotte at our apartment complex, and where we lived. And my mom worked as a maid, my dad worked as a maintenance man for the apartment complex. So by 1984, I had finished the programming stuff and was done with my AA and EDP, and really couldn't figure out what I was going to do, because I could not get rehab to pop for a computer at that point, even though the XTs had just hit the market and all that stuff was becoming big. I was still at the Commodore 64 level, using Eric Bowman at Proticon Accessibility's 64 reader system with the Commodore 64, which some of you may have heard of. I remember quite well. So computers were really still, the mainstream world of computers was still out of range for me at that point. And I could not get rehab unless I had a guaranteed job, once again, to help me out. We all know the story about rehab. So I went to work for PTL. As it happened, with the Commodore 64, I joined a users group, and I met these two guys at the users group, who, as it turned out, were executives for the PTL television show. And if you can imagine, I had this hacker program known as Dissector. It was written by a guy named Mike J. Henry. And it would crack anything that Commodore did, that any of the Commodore applications, even third-party stuff, Electronic Arts, it really didn't matter. Dissector cracked them all. And so I had this software, and these guys knew it, and these two top executives of the PTL television show would take me to lunch. I went to work for the record company, I'll get to that in a minute, but these two guys would take me to lunch, and every lunch they'd go, "Hey, Dana, can we blow by your hole and spin one?" And what they meant was, can we go by and look at your games, because I would trade games with all these kids and stuff on the Commodore 64. All these games I couldn't play, but I knew they were hot among the people who could, and so I had them for trading power and to sort of stay in touch with what was going on with the Commodore 64. The best I could do was the Infocom games and a word processor that I used called EasyScript to process text that was accessible, and one BBS application called Ravix by Ron Hayden that allowed me to set up a BBS in my house that was all fairly user-friendly with the C64 reader from Bowman. But in any case, I got to a level where with these guys where they got me this job working for the record company. Well, the two girls who were doing the telephoning for the record company at that point to sell the records to the Christian bookstores were told to give me some of their cards, their file cards, to start trying to sell Jim and Tammy's books, records, and tapes to the Christian bookstores across the country that we knew about from the Christian Bookstore Seller Association. Well, they did. They gave me all the garbage, all the stuff they couldn't get anything out of. Well, I got ready and sat down on the telephone in my first week there, and I started calling these stores and talking to them about this and that and just kind of having chit-chats with this one and that one. Well, the first month I did $4,000 worth of orders, which was phenomenal because this was all garbage accounts they couldn't get a thing out of. They just wouldn't buy the stuff. Well, as it turned out, these two guys that were in charge of the television station and a wonderful man named Erica Coyne, who was in charge of the record company And he and his wife sang on the television show quite a bit. And I knew quite a bit of the guys. If you're familiar at all with that era of, you know, spiritual television, I knew a lot of those folks very well out there. Bob and Jeannie Johnson, Eric and Roslyn. I was on the show. You know, it was just, it was a big thing that they had hired this blind guy and he had made gold out of garbage. And so they appointed me the manager of the telemarketing part department of this record company. And now I was these two girls' boss. So things have a way of turning around. But in any case, I worked for PTL until April of 1985. Regina and I had pretty much decided by this time we wanted to move to California. I had gotten in touch with some friends of mine out in California who had started this limited equity housing cooperative called 17th Street Commons in Sacramento. It was a condo project that was completely accessible, 25 units. My friend Ralph Black at this point worked for the state, for the Northern California Community College Consortium, and what this guy did eventually got himself to the position where he was certifying resource people's credentials. In other words, the folks that worked the resource rooms in the mainstream public schools, he certified their credentials. And since we had some significant problems with these folks when we were growing up with them, this guy now had the power to say yay or nay of whether they got their tickets or not. But in any case, he was quite well acquainted with the rehab system out in California. And so Regina and I had pretty much decided we were going to move to California. So that summer, July 29th, actually 28th, July 28th, that summer, we packed up and packed all our stuff into a U-Haul truck and drove to California. We sold our car and moved to California. Not knowing what we were headed for. Regina was working by that time, as you know, the divestiture of AT&T occurred on January 1st, 1984. This separated Southern Bell and AT&T and all of its related local affiliates so that AT&T no longer had their fingers in all the local pies. Regina went with AT&T, became an executive marketing secretary for their marketing people, stuck it out with them, managed to pull off a transfer. One of the only two jobs available in California was one was in San Francisco and the other was in Sacramento. Regina got the one in Sacramento. We did not know that before we left. We found it out in Oklahoma. I can still remember standing at a payphone in Oklahoma and calling her supervisor here in Charlotte and asking her if she got the job and them telling us on the, and Regina and I just whooping and hollering at this payphone at this gas station parking lot because we knew finally that she had the job in California, you know, and it was absolutely amazing that we had gone on that much faith to that something good was going to happen about this. But we made it to California. We moved into a hotel for the first month. We stayed in a hotel at 16th and Capitol, and 16th and N, actually, the Capitol View Motel. We loved it. It was a very wonderful bonding time in our life. At that point, I immediately got integrated back into the system. Within a month, I had put together my resume, excluding all the bad stuff, had landed. As it happened, there was a programmer for the State of California Franchise Tax Board who had died. He was a diabetic. He died on the job. They had bought him, you said it, an HP 125 for his home and for the office. I got both of them given to me along with his job because I knew how to write COBOL programs and the related job control language and Dial-A-Core and all the, you know, kind of mainframe sort of stuff that we used. And so in 1985, November of 1985, I went to work for the state of California under a special program created through the JETPA program out there that allowed me to sign on as a service assistant in electronic data processing. And, you know, didn't even have to test for it. I just got hired because they needed somebody to fill this position. So I went to work for the state. Regina went to work for AT&T, and we started some of the best years of our life. Really, things turned around there. We loved living at the co-op. There were some really neat people. I've got some great tapes that I'll share via my own podcast or segments on BCT if Larry's interested in them. Of good stuff that happened to us there and fun things we got to do there. There were some really neat people there. All of them, working, enjoying life and having a good time living at this limited equity housing cooperative. Well, we stayed there until 1987. I was president of the Management and Finance Committee. My friend Ralph, who I had known since the third grade, was the president of the co-op. We could see that things were going wrong with the project. It was scaled on a 30-year model. We got $1.5 million from the National Cooperative Bank in Washington. We got $448,000 from the Sacramento Housing and Redevelopment Authority to build this place. we had to do something. We were scared. Ralph and I could both see that the model wasn't fitting what the guys were spending. And the board was outvoting us on everything. We could not make them aware of the fact that they were spending too much money. So Ralph and I both got scared. I bailed in 1988. He bailed in 1987. In 1989. Yeah, he bailed the year after I did. We couldn't hang because we knew it was going to go haywire. And it did. As it happened, they folded up shop in 1995 and got taken back over by the Capital Area Development Authority, and it's now a CADA apartment complex. We got out of that project because of the way things went. I continued to work for the state up until the beginning of 1988 when I decided I really wanted, but by this time I had gotten really involved with Ted and NTEC, his first company, Ted Hinter and his first company, NTEC, who actually really wrote the base level JAWS program. In fact, my first serial number was 27 on my first copy of JAWS, which was a beta version, and our joke was the most popular command or routine was routine not installed yet, because that's what you heard just about everywhere you went in the program at that point. But it was fastly becoming the screen reader we wanted. We had discussed, based on our work with the voice processor, a device from Maryland Computer Services, and the programmable macro keys and all these things that, eventually would become macros and subsequently become scripts in the latest versions of JAWS. We discussed how to implement these into JAWS, and JAWS was a name that we both loved immediately. A lot of us, that were involved with TED at that point, all loved the name because of the movie, and his acronym, Job Access with Speech, of course, was quite appropriate. So, he got some money from George Joyce and started up Hinter Joyce, and got some programmers involved. A guy, a really, really, really sharp guy named Jeff Deline, was involved in the project, and these guys were good programmers, and they got on top of this thing. And Wakefield and all his crew was doing the news bits thing, and get about ready to get started on that. And the Braille printers were getting popular, the Romeos and the popcorns, the popcorn machines we called them, and all of the devices were really scaling up. TSI was doing Vert, and still had the Total Talk PC, the HP 150, there were a lot of companies jumping in the bandwagon. In fact, two of those people were Doug and Susan Jaffries, the authors of, at that point, Word Talk and a few other programs. They did work, for the base level MS-DOS word processing programs and database programs and stuff. I guess they wrote some stuff. I don't remember all their stuff, but they are now, deeply involved in Window Eyes. So in any case, this started the whole process of evolution for me of this this stuff. I got an XT and got into the use of all of the DOS commands, learned how to write a batch file, learned DOS and how to use it, and got pretty good at manipulating systems, and got hot on this software, all the related command structures and stuff within the different screen reader applications that were available. And there were some weird ones out there. Deborah Norvell of Grassroots Computing wrote a program called Video Voice, and Bob Artuzzi wrote a program called Enable Reader. He was a programmer from Berkeley, and there was just a lot of programs out there that people were trying to find the screen reader of choice, the program of choice, the one that would work for them. So I got good at all this stuff, and I started with Ralph, a consulting firm, DNR Consulting. We took several contracts, working for rehab, working for ourselves. We put together a survey, a technology survey. We went around to different seminars and implemented it and got people to take it and scored it and built a statistical database where we could sort of plot things that were going on, within this technology spectrum, as it were. We liked it. It was interesting to us. Things were rolling along pretty good. Regina was still working for AT&T, and her mother got sick. In 1989, Regina's parents were not getting the care she felt they deserved in Anderson, South Carolina. I had had a slump in the consulting business due to the fact that a lot of people with a lot more money and a lot more recognition, I guess, in the overall sense, not in a local area sense, but in an overall sense, at the national level and throughout the network of all these companies nationwide, were getting the good contracts, and I wasn't picking up anything really hot. And the whole thing came to a point where we decided that we had to come back to South Carolina because Regina was very concerned about her parents, particularly her mother. As it turned out, this would be a good move because Regina spent the last year she would ever spend with her mother. But in any case, she and I got our stuff together in 1989 and once again did the U-Haul, only this time we towed our car, which was fun. We moved back to Anderson, South Carolina, which is Regina's hometown. She began to go to work for the hospital system. At this point, she had quit AT&T completely and went to work for the hospital system and was quite successful, really. She got cross-trained. She became a unit secretary. She became a nursing assistant. She would eventually go through monitor tech training and learn how to read life monitors so that she could watch those monitors on a critical care floor. She learned a lot of good skills at the hospital. That served her in good stead for a great long while. But in any case, I didn't like it. South Carolina was not my thing. Anderson was another small town. There were a lot of backwards attitudes. There were not much in the way of public resource bases or services available, no public transportation, no jobs, a lot of closed minds. No one was even in any way, shape, or form ready to believe at this point that a blind person could do much in the area of computers. So this didn't lend itself to my talent or my skills at that point. I tried getting on at the School for the Blind in Spartanburg, South Carolina as a consultant because I had a criminal record. They wouldn't hire me. So that was just out of the question. So in any case, I lasted 6 months. I moved back to California in January, the day after my birthday. My birthday was January 7th, 1990, and I moved back to California, or actually I left on the bus to go back to California on January the 8th. I returned to California on a 5-day Greyhound bus trip. 5 days and nights spent on the bus. It was that important to me to get back to California, and I went back to Sacramento. Tried to figure out what I was going to do. I was staying with a friend, one of my buddies that was a paramedic that you may remember I told you I lived with in the 70s in the mountains, had moved to Palm Springs and had started a commercial pool service company down there. And I, in my callings around the state talking to people, I'd gotten a hold of him, and he told me, man, why don't you come down here and check things out? We got this thing down here called the Braille Institute, and why don't you come down here and check it out? Maybe you'd go to work for them, So I I went down to Palm Springs. I spent about a month in Palm Springs checking things out. I actually did end up moving to Palm Springs. I went to work for the United Cancer Research Society first, doing telephone solicitation. I did that and got paid for it from my apartment. And his secretary, my buddy's secretary, recorded all the stuff I needed on tape for me to make my phone calls when she was sitting there waiting on stuff to happen in the office of the pool company and had downtime. So it worked out good for all of us at that point. I got integrated into the blind service organizations there. There were two. There was the Desert Blind Association, and there was a woman there who was blind who needed some help with her computer. And I went in there and helped her with her computer and got to know those folks. And they got me in touch with the Braille Institute. I met their low vision age consultant out there at the Braille Institute. And I met the counselor. And the two of them convinced me to apply for a job there and that they would go to bat for me with the director, even though I had a record. They both knew it. So they did, I did, and they hired me. And they hired me as the student advisor. My primary job was going to be to computerize and automate the registration process, which normally took the first week of school. Everybody's sitting around waiting to be drug into an office one at a time and somehow figure out how to automate this whole process. In the meantime, Regina was getting ready to come back out here. I returned back to South Carolina that summer of 1990. And Regina and I closed up shop here, in South Carolina. Did not rent a U-Haul this time. We packed up our stuff in boxes and sent it out to the apartment I had rented and was living in Palm Springs. And we drove by car out to California again. We enjoyed the trip. We love doing this sort of road trip. I'll get to that in a little bit. We always enjoyed the road trips. They were very interesting, although we did say that, you know, you've been on the road too many times and you've traveled I-40 too many times when the lady at the Candy Store Museum in Oklahoma, at the Casey Jones Railroad Museum in Oklahoma City recognizes you on your third trip through. You know you've been on that road too many times. But that really did happen. It's quite a memory of ours to have stopped at this place on all three of our trips across country and met this same lady at the candy store. But that happened, and I hope she's gone when we go back out again. But in any case, we moved out to Palm Springs in August of 1990, and I went to work for the Braille Institute in September. Well, I was fairly knowledgeable in programs like professional file and record keeping programs that were fairly simple, straightforward databases, and I quickly built a database to keep track of all the students and just on a standalone computer. And within a month I had the whole thing figured out of how to register all these students that came from all over the desert areas to visit this Braille Institute one day a week. And so I had it all done, and they didn't know what else to do with me. Well, they had an any and all other duties as assigned clause in my duty statement that I signed when I went to work there. So they found out Dana knew all the blind guy tricks. You know, he knew all the stuff. I mean, he had done it. He had been there. I was the only totally blind person at the Braille Institute in Palm Springs. Everybody else was sighted. There was one other legally blind person that worked there, but everybody else was sighted. I don't have a problem with that, but they capitalized on my blindness. They put me to work anytime a teacher for a class was not there, except for the arts and crafts classes, and the cooking classes. I taught every other class in the place. Whenever, as needed, on demand, I could improvise on the spur of the moment and come up with a lesson for sensory awareness, independent living skills, living with visual loss, Braille, speech, rights and resources for the blind, you name it, I was good at winging it. And I came up with a class and could walk in with 5 minutes' notice and substitute in front of a group of students. They used me for public speaking. I went to Rotary Club luncheons and Mason meetings and Lions Club meetings and ladies' teas and all these different things with a publicity person and spoke on behalf of the Braille Institute. I was on TV several times, involved in a video series project called Insight on Eyesight that they did. Quite a lot of things were, you know, they liked what I did, and so I got involved in, and it worked out okay. I liked it, except for the fact that I felt overused and underpaid. The computer thing really had gone by the wayside because I had even brought my own computer and synthesizer and software to use. They had $30,000 worth of equipment there in the visual aids lab and in the technology lab, you know, but they wouldn't let me use any of it. You know, I brought my own stuff to use, which was cool. That was all right. I had it, didn't mind, you know. But I sort of got to feeling a little bit used toward the end of it. By this time, as you know, in 1991, on July 26th, George Bush Sr. signed into law, Public Law 101-336, that was the Americans and is the Americans with Disabilities Act. I served on an advisory committee under Senator Dole in writing this. In fact, the law has some of my own words in it. In any case, my friend Tom Jelen, who was the counselor at Braille, and I decided to start our own consulting business, and we started a company called DART, Disability Awareness and Resource Training, that was to provide people with ways to implement the ADA that would be both cost-effective and useful to the disabled community in the area. Well, as you guys all know, of course, the ADA got slaughtered. A bunch of money grubbers took it to court. There are currently 1,236 cases or something like that that have been stalled dead at the federal level for years now, and God knows when they'll ever get kicked loose. The Supreme Court won't touch them. You know, nobody within the George Bush Jr. administration is even talking about them. You know, all of this problem has resulted as a result of ATA because of people suing people over implementation or non-implementation of ADA. So, fortunately, the rest of the world kind of saw the light, I feel like, anyway, and decided they were going to do something about disability issues. And in a great many areas now, the ADA politics has become a standard bill of fare. We have lots of audible traffic signals here in Charlotte. They're everywhere. And I oftentimes wonder what this place sounds like in the dead of night with all those things going off with no one around. But, you know, it's just, it's neat that the people have gotten acceptant of those things. I wish that we had had a lot of these things when I was younger that people have. And some of them want and some of them don't want now. But in any case, I continue to work for the Braille Institute until October. I got fed up with the whole thing. They decided that it was either illegal or unethical. I never could figure out which, for me to be moonlighting doing my own consulting business. And so I was pretty much put in the position to make a choice, and I left Braille Institute. They wouldn't give me any more money. They really didn't want anything else you know, from me other than that I be completely at their disposal to do anything except clean the toilets and drive the buses. You know, I got fed up with it and I quit. Spent the next few years in a couple of different areas. Tom and I tried the disability awareness thing. It really didn't take off. I really don't know exactly why. We were collaborating with another fella that worked for an independent living center there. And the three of us really tried to make a go of it. I mean, we put a lot of our own money into it, a lot of our own time, effort, labor, and love into it. It just really wasn't getting it. So I decided to get into the computer software game again, and I picked up a language called Turbo Pascal. I had talked to some people about this language, and it was fairly popular in the early 90s. It was a pretty good, fast programming language that offered you a whole lot more than compiled basic programs at that point, which is what you had available to you with the RON45 DOS module that would allow you compiled BASIC programs. Turbo Pascal offered you some better usage of language that would give you more versatility in what you could do with your code architecture and stuff. And I got into it heavy, and I liked it. It was cool. I had gotten hooked up with one of the students whose husband was a minister. And he had written some basic programs, and some other guys he knew had written some programs, and they wanted to upgrade them. So we all got together, and I went to work on these five programs, and we started a company called Future Vision Software, Inc. And it was a Christian-based computer software company. We had five programs released on the commercial market. We worked packaging these things out of the garage. Of one of the guys' houses. We had a shrink wrap machine out there. We had the boxes, we had the labels, we had everything. I did the marketing on the telephone from my house. I had actually three lines into my house at that point. I had one line for the standard telephone and that I used for my phoning. I had one line for the credit card terminal. At that point, I had a talking Discover credit card terminal that Discover had financed building. That allowed me to take credit card orders over the phone. And I had another phone line that was used for the computer and the fax machine. And, we began to do business as Future Vision Software, Inc. Well, everything was going along fine through 1992 and 93 until the fall of 1993. I had a habit of cruising the bulletin boards. At that point, BBS's systems were still popular, BBS systems, bulletin board systems, which were little, servers. That's what I'd call them, sort of like a server. People set them up on their own computers. You could log in via a phone line and download programs, upload programs, look through their message bases, see what they had on their computer, sort of thing like that. Even sometimes chat with a system operator if they happen to be around. At that point, the internet was something that was just being talked about, getting started off the ground. At that point, I was still in the DOS world, even though I knew HJ was working on Windows 3.1 for workgroups. The Windows package for the JFW for 3.1 never really got it together. Before that happened, I'm getting a little ahead of myself on the software development versus my own life, but in 1993, cruising a bulletin board, I found this bulletin board in Massachusetts called the Christian Connection. All five of my programs raped of their copy protection, all zipped up in a nice little neat zip file for somebody to download. And when I got there, it had been hit 472 times already on the hit counter. Needless to say, the whole thing fell apart. At that point, CD-ROM drives and everything were becoming popular. The next thing we knew, all of the disk-based programs were just completely washed out because of CD-ROMs coming out. In 1994, people by that time were buying the Pentium 2 level machines and were getting, still using Windows 3.1. Windows 95 was about to come out. It really became very discouraging because the development was so shaky and things were happening so fast that it was very difficult to keep up with it. Regina and I had a situation in our lives at that point, and here's where I got to weave some more life into it. Regina and I have not had any children. In 1993, sometime over Christmas and New Year's, 1993, Regina became pregnant. We learned of this in 1994, in January of that year. April of 1994, she miscarried and we lost the baby. It was our one and only experience. It hurt us both very badly. We were both very resentful. We were very excited about the prospect of having a child. Even though it was late in our marriage, we were 12 years into our marriage, we still were very excited about the whole thing, and it hurt. It was a real blow to us, so much so that by July of that year, Regina couldn't take it anymore. She was working all this time throughout medical facilities. She worked for Eisenhower Medical Center out there. She had no problem changing jobs from South Carolina to Palm Springs. She went out there and went to Eisenhower Medical Center and went in one day and was hired the next, and with her skills, and went to work for Eisenhower Medical Center on the oncology ward. So she learned all the terminally ill stuff and all the oncology stuff out there. In 1994, anyway, she came back to South Carolina, to Anderson, South Carolina. I was soon to follow in November. I just couldn't hang. There was nothing going on for me in California. It really was just a bad thing. If I stayed there much longer, I would have probably gotten sucked back into my darker world again. So I packed it in. We packed up more boxes, 16 of them this time, and I sent them via regular U.S. mail parcel post. Back to Anderson, South Carolina, and we moved back to South Carolina against my will, but this time things would change. Things would be better. In 1994 as well, I wound up the corporation Future Vision Software, Inc. with my partner Jesse Cross and my other partner Steve Grohl. We pretty much decided the thing was a wash. Sales had fallen off, and so that wound up the software company. I got to go back to South Carolina via train this time, and it was my first experience with the railroad system. And I gotta tell you, if you have the money to spend and the time to take, it is a wonderful way to travel. I just can't say enough about it. I had a wonderful time on the train. It was kind of a cleansing experience from some of the bad resentment I had left from California, sort of a way of buffering the transition between California and going back to South Carolina that kind of kept me in balance when I got there, when I got to South Carolina. In any case, I arrived in South Carolina, and Regina and I were graciously helped by her sister and my brother-in-law, who got us a trailer and set it up on some land they had, and we moved into that. And that year, the big highlights at that point were Regina going through some job transition to get hired again back at the Anderson Area Medical Center, where she had previously worked in 1989 through 1990. Which took a little bit, but wasn't too hard to do, and she eventually did get hired back on there. And I went to guide dog school to get my first guide dog. Having been a cane traveler all my life, this was going to be a new experience for me. I was very uneasy about it because I wasn't sure that I would trust the dog or allow the dog to work for me. As it turned out, I went to Southeastern in Florida, Palmetto, Florida. Loved the experience. Can't say enough about it. For those of you who use guide dogs, I have not posted this anywhere yet, so this is kind of a little tidbit. But while I was at guide dog school, getting to know Willow and her getting to know me, she was a very strong Labrador, yellow lab, and she had a lot of torque in those back hips and could really get up and go. And in fact, myself and another legally blinded, partially sighted, I like Lynette's term, that's what we called them all through our life, partially sighted, woman were the front runners in the class every time we ever went anywhere because we both walked so fast and traveled so well with the dogs. But Willow and my roommate's dog, Comet, they were so powerful that we wanted to hitch them up to a car and see if they could pull a car, and Mike Sargent wouldn't let us do it. So anyway, at guide dog school, I wrote these lines that I call the guide dog's creed, and I haven't published it anywhere, but it's kind of neat. It goes like this: if there's a doggy in heaven as happy as me, I wish I could be them and my master could see. That's sort of my impression of how I think a guide dog might feel about themselves and their position in our lives, and you know, what they would be willing to give up for us, which is their life. And many times they have, in an attempt to save our lives. In fact, the final big test among others is the what we call TC Day or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it is. It's where traffic checks are done, whether the dog will get in front of you when one of the instructors pulls in front of you in a car without notice under several different conditions, crossing an intersection, turning a corner, different things, pulling in a driveway in front of you to see what the dog will do. Great experience. I really enjoyed going to the school and getting to meet a lot of neat people there, and the experience of getting Willow. I would be leaving out part of the story here if I did not bring in it to this point the fact that I have had two cats up to this point since 1985 and 1987. When we moved into the co-op in California, in Sacramento, the first day there, a lady found a kitten, a young cat, a kitten in the alley who had been hit by a car. She took him to the vet, got him all fixed up, had his back hips pinned back together and everything, and he was well enough to come home, and she couldn't keep him because she was on crutches, and she was very much afraid she might put one of her crutches down on him because he liked to stay around her feet. So she was just looking for someone to take him off her hands, and we did. And so thus we got Onyx, which was our first black cat, a male cat whom we eventually had neutered and declawed in front because we decided he was going to remain an indoor cat for his life. And he did so. In 1987, a friend of mine found some cats in an alley and some kittens and by his house and brought him in and took care of him until they were old enough to give away. One of them was black, and I took it off his hands, and he became Shadow to us. And Onyx and Shadow had traveled with us. When I left California in 1994 by train, I had no way and no money to send Onyx and Shadow to Anderson, South Carolina. So I was very upset about this, but I managed to find an elderly woman who in Palm Springs wanted Onyx and Shadow, even though they were older cats by this time. They were like 9 and 7 years old or something like that. But in any case, she wanted them, so I left them with her. In 1995, I got a call from her, and I had contacted her just to let her know where I was once I got in South Carolina and everything. And she asked me, did I want the cats back? And I said, well, sure, but I can't afford to, you know, have them transported. She said, no. I'm moving to Texas. I will send them to you on an airplane, you know. This she did. She packed them in their carrier along with their stuff and had them sent to me on the airplane. And Regina's nephew and us went up to the Greenville, South Carolina airport and picked them up. They had all kinds of notes all over the carrier saying how cute they were and how neat they were and how nice they were from people that had, you know, encountered them along the way. It was really kind of a neat experience. And so I guess there's some truth in the saying that if you love someone or something, set it free, and if it's really yours, it'll come back to you, because we had Onyx and Shadow back now. When I brought Willow home, this was seen as an extreme act of betrayal by the cats on my part. I didn't think they would ever forgive me. Onyx actually did get used to Willow, and some of you may have read my postings about how well Onyx and Willow got along, and how well Shadow and Willow didn't, but it was kind of neat to have the three of them. They were our family and kind of took the place of our children, and Willow was a great experience. She loved working at the Pallet Patch, which is where I'm about to go now. As I said, I had previously had or done, just for the sake of getting a transcriber off my back when I was 14, the Christianity move of salvation, and just went through the moves to get this woman off my back. And because I dealt with her every day in school, school. And it really got to be, excuse me, a significant problem with her hounding me about my soul and salvation and stuff. So I, in 1995, Regina had started attending this little church out on Highway 81 South in South Carolina. And the minister was a man she had known since childhood, who was part of the coordinators of her youth program when she went to church as a kid, and eventually himself became a pastor, and now pastored this little church called Beulah Land Baptist Church. Regina had spoke to him about me, and he came by one day to talk with me, and I began to talk with him about my concept of a God of my understanding versus his concept of God in Christianity terms. And he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll let you come to church on Wednesday night and talk to my congregation about whatever you want to talk about. And in exchange for that, I want you to do a little exercise for me. And I said, well, okay, what's that? He said, get the Bible, and I want you to read every day a chapter out of the book of John for 30 days. That's all, just 30 days. He said, there's not enough chapters to keep you going all 30 days, so you have to start over again. But read a chapter in the book of John every day for 30 days. So I said, okay, fine. So the next Wednesday night, I went to his church, met a lot of people, two of which were Jane and Tommy Crocker, whom you've already heard about in the story I posted sometime last month on the list, and a lot of other really neat people. And I told them that really my concept of God consisted primarily of wanting to be of maximum service to my fellow man, and in so doing, hopefully fulfill whatever destiny was supposed to be for me here on this earth while I was here in this life. And I began reading in the book of John just like I promised the pastor I would, and it was sometime during about the second week, I guess, that I came upon one of these moments of clarity. And I had watched a program earlier that year on some scientific experiment that a doctor did. He had three people who were dying. One was an 80-year-old elderly man who was dying of natural causes, or some sort of older condition in a nursing home. The other was a 41-year-old woman, as I recall, who was dying of ovarian cancer. And the next one was a baby, I believe, that was something on the order of 2 to 3 years old and had some sort of form of advanced leukemia anyway. It was not projected to live. What he did was take all three of these subjects and place them in a very, intense, a very, very sensitive weight beds that would weigh these people constantly. And at the moment of death, he weighed them prior to and immediately after death. He had these weights being taken constantly. Well, the purpose of the experiment was to prove that the human soul, or whatever force leaves the body at the moment of death, has weight and mass. And in fact, what he determined was that the all three subjects weighed 21 grams less after the moment of death than prior to it. And in that, combined with another moment of clarity during this little exercise in the book of John I was taking, which was, what if I die and I get to wherever you go when you're after, when you die, and I find out that there really is a God, and he really did have a son named Jesus that walked here on this earth, and I didn't believe in him, so I don't get to go to the heaven everyone foretold of within the Christian sector. Then I got to another point where I said, what if I do believe in him and I die and I find out there isn't one, there was no God, it was all something someone thought up or believed in and just didn't exist. I get to the end of the road and like everyone else, just go to wherever you go where there is no God and no heaven or no hell or either one. I decided that rather than risk it, I would rather get to heaven and find out that there was no God, but I believed him anyway and tried to do good on this earth and live a good life regardless of the outcome after I died. This is what is known in Christian circles as the fire insurance theory, I have come to learn, and it is the only aspect of Christianity that I've been able to cling to. I went through this conversion process. This time it meant something to me. And as a result of it, I will tell you, I am not what I would consider at all to be a good Christian. I stumble, I fall, I still succumb to bad behavior and lots of other things that others may subscribe to as something you shouldn't do as part of being a Christian. What I will say is, I'm not perfect, and I'll be the first one to proclaim that. I love an old hymn called "Just As I Am," and if he wants me, he's going to have to take me just as I am. I don't ever claim to be a prophet, and I don't claim to be anything but a human being, hopelessly flawed. I do the best I can with what I've got to work with, and I do a whole lot better now than I used to. So, I'm maybe not what I ought to be, but I'm a long ways from where I used to be in the eyes of some people. I marvel at these people that have their cookie cutters and come along and try to cut you out and say, well, if you don't fit into this mold, then you're not a Christian. Well, to me, what that says is, when you cut cookies out of cookie dough, there's a lot left over when you cut out that cookie and shape it into the mold. And who are you to say all this leftover dough is worthless? Whoever God made me to be, that's up to him to decide how to reshape me, not you. So, and consequently, I don't get along too well in the Christian circles because I'll openly admit my sin. I'll openly admit things they consider to be behaviors I should attempt to modify and don't, such as smoking. I still smoke. It's my last bad habit, I guess, along with drinking coffee. I have my opinions on that too, but I won't go into them here. In any case, this whole process took place in 1995 at Beulah Land Baptist Church, and I got hooked up with Jane and Tommy Crocker, who ran the Pallet Patch, and who offered me a job. What they wanted to do was automate their facility. They had someone who was interested in the company if they could get it up to current standards of a manufacturing and recycling facility that was involved with some of the bigger pallet manufacturers, associations and stuff, Grocery Management Association and places like that that manufacture large-scale pallets. And these guys were interested in their factory, and they would be very much interested in what I could do to help them. So we got into the project heavily. I really enjoyed it. It was a challenge. I'm not going to go into a lot of details about it because I could spend a whole nother career cast talking just about the Pallet Patch and how much we sweated over it and what a success it was when we finally got it to where we ended up with it. What I will say is it was a completely different place by the time we were done, and the three of us were completely different people by the time it was done. It was a great experience, a learning experience. I don't think I would do it again. Robotics and large-scale industrial machinery is something I knew nothing about, but really was excited about learning about. And Industrial Robotics is a company, Industrial Robotics Systems, that makes large-scale equipment for factories, and it was a toss-up whom we hated worse, Industrial Robotics IRS or the federal IRS. But nevertheless, to make the long and story short, I worked at the Pallet Patch from 1996 through 2001, when Jane and Tommy sold their company and got out of business, the pallet business. Things were changing in the industry, and it was a good time to sell, and they got a good profit on what they did, and they really had other goals and aspirations in life. Tommy wants to be a missionary and has been back and forth to Honduras several times, working in the missions field, and they each have their, you know, their aspirations and stuff that they want to work on. So in any case, as it coincidentally happened in 2001, my wife Regina met with a fatal accident. Not that fatal, but to her it was disastrous, and I can understand why. Regina has worked all of her life, and ever since she left home, like me, when she was 17, she's got her first job and went to work. So in 2001, one night, working third shift at the hospital, she was running for a crash cart to save someone's life, and she hit a piece of wet. The crash carts were stored in a closet in front, across from the elevators on each floor, and the floor outside the elevators was tile, while the halls were carpeted. Some janitorial person had cleaned the floor and had not put out a wet floor sign. Regina hit it, getting to this closet. Slipped, fell, broke both her ankles, blew out her right knee, and popped two discs in her back, and ended her career. She was no longer capable of walking the hospital floors all night long, running under stat conditions for various and sundry things. The miles of walking that went along with her job, she was no longer capable of doing. We went through a year of recovery with her, hospital surgery, all kinds of stuff. You know, she spent a lot of time in a wheelchair, on a walker, and in 3D boots and all kinds of apparatus to get around. And what we ended up with was that she was, in every sense of the word, physically disabled now. This has taken its toll on her in that it's affected her psychology. Even though she's lived with me, it's affected her, ability to handle herself from an attitude standpoint in a lot of ways, because she's worked, and the work ethic is strongly instilled in her too. And this was something she got a good deal of her self-image from, was her responsibility to herself and to us, to the marriage, and to help support it. And so it really took its toll on her. This was July of 2001. Fortunately, I was around at this time, had a lot of time on my hands, was able to help her. We got through the first year of hell on earth, and got her to the point where we were now ready to legally take on the insurance company and the hospital and attempt to get some compensation for this accident. We did. Another year later, in 2003, we managed to settle a case out of court. We paid a lawyer $40,000, and he wrote exactly four letters. He filed two forms with the state. He had two or three meetings with us in his office, and he showed up at the out-of-court settlement hearing. And that was the extent of what he did. So therefore, when it come time to file Regina's case with the government for her SSDI, I am now going to represent her. We are at the third level appeal at this point and waiting on the hearing at the administrative law judge level. This will take place sometime next year, as best we can figure out, based on how fast they're getting through the 6,000 cases that were in front of her when we moved from Anderson, South Carolina in February and got the case, change of venue on the case here in April. So it's going to be a while. In the meantime, I'm doing this and that, working as a consultant still, doing shark training. You know, I went to a formal window eyes training class in August in Denver and at GW, and you know, got the ins and outs of eyes. And the neatest thing about that wasn't so much the window eyes training course, although that was interesting, but was to get to go through Beyond Sight, where I started getting brought up to date with this technology. When I worked at the Palette Patch, I basically did one thing all that time, which was, you know, operate this huge software-controlled bank of switches that turned on and off different machinery under time parameters, under different situations and conditions, based upon a lot of numbers, would turn on different pieces of machinery to allow this plant to operate. It was fun, it was neat, but it was all I did. And when I came home, the last thing I wanted to do was mess around with a computer. So I didn't even have a computer at home. And when I moved to Charlotte, that's the first thing I did, was get one. I got a computer, got set up here, and in February, and began exploring all of this new stuff that was out there. So while I have considerable experience at a lot of different areas, what I have missed out on is a lot of the growth curve. And where I find myself now is in the catching up phase and getting brought up to date and getting current on standards and various things that have changed within the industry and all these new things that we have available to us. And it's interesting. I never get bored with it. I always wake up wondering what I'm going to learn today. Because since I have joined the Blind Cool Tech list and begun listening to podcasts, I have learned a great deal. I listen to a lot of podcasts. Where I'm going with this is I got into satellite radio earlier this year. Somebody gave me a satellite radio, and they thought I would enjoy it, and I did. I had gotten a little bit of experience with it via Dish Network in South Carolina, had the Sirius network on their satellite receiver, and I kind of got into it a little bit. But I had approached them here when I first got here, and they gave me this radio, these people gave me this radio, about having a channel for the disabled. They have every kind of other forum represented on their dial. I mean, gays, lesbians, left wing, right wing politics, everything. What I hope to see is that we one day get a channel of our own on one of these big satellite networks. Regardless of how much of a role podcasting plays in the new age radio, web radio broadcasting, I'm told that satellite and other major commercial radio markets scout podcasts, just as major league ball teams scout the AA farm teams and stuff. This is done quite regularly. In fact, Larry, you might not know when you're being listened to by anyone. It's something that it just out there, they do it. They want to pick up, you know, tomorrow's broadcasters. And I really want these folks to devote a channel to a forum for disabilities where we can all have a nationally recognized platform from which to deal with things. I am very much a coalitionist by nature, politically. I do not support separatist organizations. I do not believe in the concept. I love the fact that California now has a coalition active and that the people within the commissions out there and so forth are disabled, who are running the ship, steering the ship, a lot of them. It gives us a lot of leverage and a lot of control in the issues that matter and how the money gets spent. I have seen the kind of what I call pop will eat itself bureaucracy in South Carolina, which is that the South Carolina Commission for the Blind also owns the skills training center and evaluation center where they spend $4,000 a month to send a person there and then send them back home and sit and wait until they maybe somehow, someday, some way find a job for them. And so they keep feeding the money back into their own system and charging themselves the whole thing. It's just absolutely amazing that this bureaucracy is allowed to exist. Meanwhile, the client sits at home. I've actually been told by a South Carolina Commissioner for the Blind counselor, Dana, you've got an SSI check. You've got a Section 8 housing voucher. You've got a food stamp card and a Medicaid card. You've got the NLS library program in your talking books. You've got the radio reading service and the radio we provide you with to read you the newspapers. Now shut up and be happy, and you get to go to camp once a week. I mean, once a year for a week. I mean, you know, this is the attitude of these folks, and you should not try to excel beyond that. And the few who have in South Carolina are in the capital, in Columbia. That's the only place it seems that someone who is blind has a chance. But in any case, enough of my expounding on political issues. My goal is to see coalition forces, get together and build common platforms to deal with disabilities and disability issues. I work under a number of circumstances in both private and school settings with students and educators and organizations from nonprofits to PTAs on advice and suggestions and ideas and things to do to solve problems facing the resource programs, facing individual students, facing the teachers. Glad to learn about places like Bookshare and stuff like that that offer alternatives to these folks. All of this stuff is stuff I'm just now getting in touch with, and the more of it I get in touch with, the better. Hence my contributions and my interest in Blind Cool Tech and a lot of the podcasts that everyone is doing, Stephen and Lynette and Adam and Jim and so many of you. I really enjoy listening to the podcasts. It's great. I have a concept of my own. As soon as I can get all the necessary software under control to do what I want to do and get all the necessary cables and wires and cards and connectors and things, microphones and everything required to do what I want to do, and everything converted to the right file type and all my ducks in a row, I'm going to put one of these together myself because I have a different sort of concept than anything I've heard so far. This is my life. That was it, wasn't it? And if you found it interesting, so be it. If you didn't, I hate it. It's been my life so far. I don't mind living it. I don't resent a bit of it. I am truly grateful for the fact that it's turned out the way it has. I am sorry that I've made my mistakes, just like anybody would. But if you process a mistake into experiential wisdom, that being knowledge, then you haven't lost on the deal. And as far as I'm concerned, I haven't lost on any of the mistakes I've made because I've managed to turn them around. Should you want to know more about any part of this life/careercast, feel free to email me, dniswonger, that's dniswonger, at carolina.rr.com. The business name is Action Consulting, ActionConsulting, all one word, carolina.rr.com. Action happens to be an acronym. I love the word action because I like taking action rather than reacting to situations and incidents and things I find myself in. Action is an acronym I use. It stands for Accessible Communication Technology Improvement Options Network, which is something I hope to set up at some point via the web, podcasting, and any other means of communication nation and worldwide I can possibly establish. So there's my goals, there's my aspirations, there's my life. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you on the flip-flop.